Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Taking a look at the National Weather Service 8 to 14 day outlook.
Looking at both temperatures and the mix of precipitation across the country, USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
So as we approach the end of the month, it looks like a relatively warm pattern, particularly across the eastern half of the country. Below normal temperatures will be confined to parts of the north, generally from the Pacific Northwest to the northern high plains. Meanwhile, in terms of precipitation, maybe a little bit more in terms of drought relief in some of our drought-affected areas. We actually expect above normal precipitation from the April 22nd to 28th timeframe. Most areas between the Rockies and the Appalachians. Drier than normal conditions, however, may return to the far west, including much of California, Oregon, and parts of Washington and the Great Basin.
This is Agriculture Today.
Where the pressure points are on you, where the pressure points are going to come for us to not necessarily get the best deal because we're spread all over the globe negotiating every one of these agreements at the same time, rather than a more strategic approach, which would have had the benefit of giving us, I think, a much greater degree of certainty about where we were headed.
At a recent Senate Finance Committee hearing on trade earlier this month, Colorado Senator Michael Bennett questioning U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer.
Obviously, you made a different choice, and I'm just curious about how you think about your response, how you think about that.
So I would note, and I think it's thoughtful to think about the things in this way. If you look at the results of the reciprocal tariff, the Western Hemisphere generally is at the lowest tariff rate. If you look at where we have our largest problems with non-reciprocity and deficit countries, it's mostly in Asia. And so you do actually see pretty strategic outcome with respect to promoting production in the Western Hemisphere as opposed to where we have all this overproduction in Asia that's given rise to our current problems on trade.
I would just say in closing, Mr. Chairman, that's true. What the ambassador said is true, but it still doesn't, I still cannot fathom why we are treating Canada and Mexico, our largest trading partners, basically the same way we're treating Beijing. It doesn't make any sense to me. It makes no sense that we would do it all at the same time like that. And we're going to have to stay on it, which is why some of us have introduced legislation to make sure that Congress begins to take its appropriate role again in making these very important trade decisions.
Moving from trade and tariffs to the Lesser Prairie Chicken, Kansas, Representative Tracy Mann.
This is just another example of a bloated bureaucracy that's doing things that hurt agriculture that they shouldn't be doing. You know, an example is the Lesser Prairie Chicken, big issue in Kansas, to your point, also Colorado, Oklahoma, Texas. The Obama administration had added this bird to the threatened species list. Trump removed it. Biden added it. We're now working to get it removed. Let's just use sound science. And the crazy thing is, if you really look at the population of the Lesser Prairie Chicken, it almost exactly mirrors rainfall. Years that we have a drought, the population goes down. Years that we get good rains, the population goes up. But we should not be impacting our oil and gas producers, also our ag producers, going through all these hoops, all these regulations to protect this bird, given the populations are actually increasing naturally, and that's what we ought to be focused on.
The Department of Interior pulled the rug out from under voluntary efforts.
So there have been voluntary efforts by producers to increase the population so that heavy-handed regulation wouldn't come upon them. The rug, you know, has been pulled out from underneath those producers, very fresh. You know, I got a phone call about a year or so ago from a producer in Southwest Kansas saying that someone, Fish and Wildlife, had spotted a Lesser Prairie Chicken on their property, one of their pastures. And that afternoon, they had to remove all of the livestock out of that pasture and each adjoining pasture as well. It just makes absolutely no sense, these regulations, what we're doing. And what it does, it just adds cost and burdens to our ag producers as they're trying to feed, fuel, and clothe the world.
Is it time to reform the Endangered Species Act?
Yeah, it absolutely is. You know, it's not just Lesser Prairie Chicken. You know, that impacts Kansas, our district. There is the great sand. There's a sand dune lizard in West Texas. There's a great, well, there are species all over the country that they used unsound science. Many times the previous administration is not willing to show their work and their rationale for how and why they added these species to the endangered species, the threatened species list. And so we're working to redo the entire process to make sure, one, that we right the current wrongs, but two, that these things can never, ever happen again.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Now looking a little bit more on the wholesale side of things, that box beef cutout value.
Tyler Cousins is the director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center.
Last week averaged about $3. Last year and this week was actually $3.37, so definitely a gain of about $37 compared to a year ago. The stronger performers in the cutout value have been the rib, the round and the loin, which we would kind of expect as we kind of are leading up to, you know, Memorial Day just coming around the corner here. We've got Easter coming up in a couple weeks here. So definitely some of that demand season there starting to kick in and seeing a little bit more demand pull for some of those cuts coming through the market there. Still seeing some gains there on the chuck and the brisket and flank. Short plate's the only one that's really seeing a little bit of weakness there, but by and large, still seeing some pretty strong gains there as far as the cutout value goes. And definitely something to keep in mind as we get much closer to the kind of the start of the unofficial start of the summer grilling season, see how this cutout value holds up.
He talks about feed cost.
It's kind of one of these things that's always kind of important to keep our eye on. It's just kind of the input cost side of things, specifically feed costs. You know, a few of the talks I've been given here over the last few weeks and months, are just kind of watching some of that information there. And, you know, obviously one of those things where I was watching as far as inputs is on the hay side of things. You know, we kind of get a couple of pieces of information as far as just overall supply availability of hay within the supply chain there. And that's December 1 and May 1 hay stocks. So obviously May 1 is coming up here pretty soon. But obviously that December 1 hay stocks number has been trending up here the last couple of years. So watching that May 1 hay stocks number, see how those supplies fared over the winter, if the producers had to feed a little bit more hay to kind of supplement maybe just overall feed and range availability for those cattle. So one of those things to look at there. Drought has definitely been one of those pictures we're watching here. USDA's World Board currently has about 39% of the major hay producing regions of the U.S., falling under an area that is experiencing drought. So definitely a larger proportion of hay producing acres within the U.S. experiencing some of that drought. You know, and as we get through spring here, you know, we can definitely see some of that picture turn if we get some needed moisture. But if we don't see that happen, then we could start to see maybe some potential impacts on the supply side to specifically hay availability as we kind of go through the summer months here. So definitely one of those things to keep an eye on. But if we kind of look at some of the price side of things on hay, you know, we've definitely been seeing a downward trend for hay prices over the last couple of years. So we've seen hay prices get the lowest in about 3, almost 4 years. Kind of sitting around that $150 per ton nationally, that price there. So definitely well below some of those prices that we were seeing, you know, even a couple of years ago that were around $200 or more per ton. So kind of another thing to look at on the feed input cost side of things is corn. You know, recent projections from USDA actually has over 95 million acres of corn to be planted this next crop season. That's up about 5 million acres from the 90.6 million acres that was planted last year. So definitely a big jump in the corn side of things. You know, so obviously if you kind of keep a trend line yield there, we'd definitely see a little bit more corn out there as far as supplies go. You know, and so currently they're projecting those acres to be higher. So we currently have prices that are actually sitting just below $5 per bushel, you know, definitely lower than what we've seen in the last couple of years, kind of in line with what we saw last year. But obviously there's still a lot of the growing season ahead, many factors that are still at play that will likely influence just overall corn acres planted and also this corn price. But I think, you know, keeping the corn and hay prices in mind and be a few of those key factors to watch over the next coming months here as far as feed cost side of the equation goes for these livestock producers.
This is Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Now, sometimes taking on a certain amount of debt is what you have to do, because the thing that actually Republicans, Democrats are terrified to tell our voters, next 10 years, almost 100% of U.S. sovereign debt is interest and Medicare. It's demographics. We got old.
David Schweikert is a representative from Arizona, speaking on the floor of the House recently. He also serves as chairman of the Joint Economic Committee.
Mr. Speaker, one of the things going on in the entire Western world, and particularly also here in the United States, we don't have enough young people. If you actually look at our demographic curves, when you hear people talk about that, you know, as soon as I say demographics, I know people turn the channel. There's a very good chance in the last 12 months we had more deaths than births. It wasn't supposed to happen for 7.5 years, according to the Census Bureau, but there's a couple data sets out there saying we may be up against already having more deaths than births. Then understand the way we deliver and finance the earned entitlements, the earned benefits, is today's worker pays for today's retirees. And last week I showed a number of charts that those numbers, functionally in 10, 20 years, it's you and your partner, you and your spouse, and a little bit more, you have your own retired person you're paying for. That's not Republican or Democrat, it's demographics. In 2033, so what, 7.5 years from now, Social Security Trust Fund is empty. The law says you cut benefits. That would be a 21% cut, meaning in functionally 8 years, we double senior poverty in America. Yet, if you talk about how you want to try to save Social Security and all the steps you have to do and all the inputs, and because it turns out it's complicated. That side over there is going to run attack ads beating the crap out of you because you mentioned the word Social Security, even though you're trying not to double senior poverty. That's how immoral this place is. And remember, our math from last year is the first full year with the Social Security Trust Fund gone. Just the shortfall is over $600 billion. The scale of what we're talking about is brutal. And Mr. Speaker, if you intend to be here another decade, you're going to get to deal with it. And every day we wait, that math gets more and more difficult. So let's go back to the Senate's reconciliation budget. Here's what they gave us. They're using a 2024 gross debt number of $21 trillion. It's really 22, but we'll let them because they made us some numbers in their budget. Remember, they played some games on their growth projections. But functionally, 32.7% of the next decade they gave us is borrowing, additional borrowing. They basically decided over the next decade, let's add another third of debt. What are we going to do? For those of us in the House who give these beautiful speeches of it's immoral to do this to our kids and crush people's future retirements, what are we going to do? Are we going to step up and say, look, Republicans, we have priorities. The White House has priorities. We just have to find ways to finance them. Are we that terrified to tell the truth?
This is Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Yeah, so steers and heifers generally discount in terms of market value because heifers tend to finish at lower weights and they're less efficient in the finishing phases. And generally, they're just discounted because of that and they finish at lower weights.
Tara Lee Hudson is a University of Nebraska at Lincoln graduate researcher.
The steer-heifer price discount really tells us, you know, how much demand there's going to be in the market for heifers to be pulled forward by feed yards.
University of Nebraska Lincoln livestock economist Dr. Elliot Dennis.
For example, from 2016 to 2020, that steer heifer price discount really stayed steady, about $15 a hundredweight. But as we started to kind of expand the herd, we were holding back heifers for retention. That price has climbed from about $15 to all the way up to about $35 a hundredweight. Now, it doesn't vary. It's not the same across the different weight classes. And what we tend to observe, which we show in the article, is that at lighter weights, it's the steer heifer price discount is larger, both nominally, so in dollars per hundredweight, and in a total percentage of the price. For example, in 2024, to show you how much this has changed, the steer heifer price discount for 500 to 600 pound was about $35 a hundredweight. On average, the 10-year average and the 5-year average was about the same, about $24 a hundredweight. Compare that to, you know, the 800, 900 pound price discount where we were at about $13 a hundredweight on average over the last 10 years, and now it's up to 21. But when we look at it from price or percentage differences, that was only about an 8% increase for the 8-9 weights compared to about 11%. So this does vary as we go through the cattle cycle, and it varies pretty considerably by weight.
So what are considerations for retaining heifers or not?
Yeah, every time we choose, make that decision not to choose a heifer into a cash value market, that we are essentially buying that heifer from ourselves at that value. And so when we think about the value that that heifer then needs to produce in calves through its lifetime, that's essentially its cost. It's fixed throughout however many calves that it gives to us. And so knowing, you know, not only is it, you know, should we retain because there's high value and potential higher cattle prices in the future, but knowing that every time we choose to forego that value, we are essentially buying it from ourselves, and then that heifer needs to pay for herself. So as that price goes up, so does the burden on her to continue to pay for herself in higher value calves and not just, you know, selling her after 5 or 6 years. So we saw a lot of producers kind of get in bad shape as we retained or bought heifers or bred cows at really high prices in 2015. And now we saw massive amounts of culling happen over the last, you know, 2 or 3 years. But a lot of those cows that we were culling, we were holding on to because they needed to pay themselves back because we bought them for such high prices the last time we were up in 2014, 2015. So just keeping that in mind, there's lots of tools out there that we can use to say, like, what is the value of the heifer, and what it, you know, for instance, some of the stuff that we produce at the University of Nebraska, like, what's the value of the heifer? What needs to go right as far as number of calves and future calf prices? We have that on our website at cap.unl.edu. There's also other tools out there, but knowing that it's just not, you know, there's value out there, but what needs to go right? And I think sometimes more importantly, like, what can go wrong if I'm choosing to retain heifers and not to sell her into the high value market that we're experiencing?
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
My name is Keith Felty. I am a farmer from Altus, Oklahoma, where my family and I farm wheat, cotton, and pasture land.
Earlier this year at a Senate Agriculture Committee hearing on the ag economy, past president of the National Association of Wheat Growers, Keith Felty.
NAWG is a federation of 20 state wheat grower associations. Today's hearing is important as the committee works to reauthorize the farm bill and address the challenges facing the agricultural economy. As I enter my 40th year in farming, the agriculture economy is facing a severe downturn, the likes of which we haven't seen since the early 1980s. NAWG greatly appreciates the hard work that leadership and committee members played in getting economic and disaster assistance signed into law this past December. That assistance is much needed across all of agriculture. However, long-term improvements to the farm safety net must be included as the committee and Congress work to reauthorize the farm bill this year. In September, most organizations at this table were in Washington, D.C. for the first-ever multi-commodity fly-in, where we highlighted the financial pressure building across American agriculture and urged Congress to pass a robust farm bill that strengthens the farm safety net. The challenges facing agriculture today differ from when the 2018 farm bill was enacted. While the farm safety net is a sound network, it must be enhanced to reflect today's realities. Increased input costs, high interest rates, and depressed commodity prices have created significant challenges for farmers in rural America. In December, the USDA reported farm sector income is forecasted to fall in 2024. When looking at the commodity level changes in farm income, wheat growers experienced a 43% decrease in net cash farm income from 2023 to 2024. That marks the lowest level in the last 15 years. These conditions underscore the need for a strong, robust, and meaningful farm bill that provides long-term certainty as we proceed into the 119th Congress. Crop insurance is the cornerstone of the farm safety net. I use crop insurance on my operation to cover natural disasters. Last year, 1 week before harvest, our operation saw a devastating hailstorm that destroyed wheat that was otherwise in excellent condition. Crop insurance is a vital component that ensures the viability of my operation and is the first line of defense against natural disasters. We must work to make crop insurance more affordable as it plays the vital role in sustaining rural America. Additionally, The PLC reference price for wheat has remained unchanged and has fallen far short of the cost of production since its introduction. Since the 2018 Farm Bill, crop inputs have increased by about 30% on average. When our past president testified on this topic in 2023, he stated, "Wheat farmers across the country are currently experiencing high prices, but at an extreme risk." Since then, wheat prices have dropped 37%. In 2025, the USDA forecasts cost of production to remain elevated at $386 per acre, which means wheat growers are projected to lose $96 per acre. NOG requests the committee make a meaningful investment in the farm safety net and increase the reference price for wheat. Wheat growers in the United States pride themselves in growing a safe, abundant, and sustainable crop that we consume here at home and export globally.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Senate budget provides for $5 trillion plus in new deficits over the next 10 years. And then you actually add in the additional spending. You start to go over even our budget reconciliation, I thought was unacceptable. One of the hardest votes I made. I can't make up my mind how much I regret.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert.
Sometimes I really regret it. Some moments I'm hoping that the leadership team that said they would work with me, because I believe we can find $1 trillion in savings in just modernization. But remember, those inefficiencies are other people's business models. So you already see the hallways full of lobbyists trying to stop them. But you take a look here. Here's the debt we were going to add. Here's the additional debt the Senate adds. They've functionally even doubled what we were talking about. Increasing the deficit results in higher interest costs. This is one of the things we forget to tell people the truth. There's a model out there, CBO actually ran it for me, saying if interest rates went up 1% on this policy baseline, and I'm tired of talking about it, in the 30-year window, you broke the Congressional Budget Office's model. Let me say that again. We broke the Congressional CBO's model. It went over 250%, except the problem is their computer only goes to 250%. It just hit it. We're now pushing levels of debt so high, we're breaking our budget models. Yay, go team. But even with what the Senate just gave us, over that 10-year period of time, stack on another $1.1 trillion of interest. Didn't buy anything, just interest. Senate borrowing their instructions. The House proposed trying to get to $2 trillion in spending reductions. Dear heaven, I hope we can be tough enough, disciplined enough to get there. I've produced all sorts of documents. I'm not one of those people giving speeches. I'm showing up with binders of ways you can get there. And much of it isn't cuts. It's just using technology to change the way we deliver services. The Senate, remember, $1 billion and $1 trillion are very, very different things. They functionally gave us $4 billion in spending reductions. That's what they thought we were worth. We sure give a lot of great speeches around here of the greatest threat to our republic. Turns out to be the scale, the speed we are burying this society in debt. And then we hit moments like this, and we're going to happy talk our way through it. We're going to lie about things about, oh, we're going to make up a pretend growth rate, and that's going to produce $2.6 trillion. Our own reconciliation budget, there's going to be $1.7 of additional cuts in discretionary. But you can't really do that in a reconciliation budget. It's completely unenforceable. I mean, we should be ashamed of ourselves.
Schweikert concludes by saying,
"This Congressional Budget Office, almost 2 months ago, did a model that says if you want to maximize growth over the next decade, pay for as much of the tax extensions as you can. So do them, because that will maintain consumption. You don't get a lot of growth from it. Where you really get the growth is the expensing side and continuing some of the business tax, the pass-through tax portions. But if you pay for it, you don't screw up the capital stack, the money that you borrow for your small business, for your home, for your car. Looks like we're going to screw it all up. Let's not let that happen, Mr. Speaker."
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Global feed use was reduced about 1.8 million tons, mainly reflecting higher feed use in the EU, partially offset by lower feed use in the U.S. and Moldova.
USDA's World Ag Outlook Board Chairman, Dr. Mark Jekinowski.
And then we made some changes to global trade, dominated by the change we made in the U.S. balance sheet. Overall, U.S. corn exports remain very competitive. Competitive U.S. prices are keeping export volumes strong. And reflecting that in the U.S. supply and demand balance sheet this month, we raised our export forecast by 100 million bushels. So now we're at 2.55 billion bushels of exports. That would be up just about 260 million bushels year over year. And then we also incorporated data from the March 1 grain stocks report. Based on that, we reduced our feed and residual use by 25 million bushels. We reduced ending stocks by 75 million bushels, and we didn't make any change to our season average market price, which remains at $4.35 per bushel.